to All Together Now. This is Charlene Spratnak. I've been thinking since President Obama's speech about the drone strikes that, well, for one thing, I've been thinking about Medea Benjamin's courageous asking him of those questions, particularly, why don't we pay compensation to the families of the innocent people we happen to kill with the drone strikes? Which, she pointed out, would be a step in making the United States safer. I've been wondering, though, if the American people really realize that we have killed hundreds, if not thousands, of innocent civilians, mostly in the tribal regions of Pakistan, through these CIA-operated drone strikes, and this has gone on not for a month, where we say, oh my gosh, this isn't what we thought was going to happen, but no, it's gone on for years. That issue of American public awareness, or the lack thereof, of the effects of much of our foreign policy on people on the ground level got me thinking about three situations in my own life when I saw that disparity played out dramatically. The first time was when I was about 11 years old, and I must have heard on the news or somehow become aware of some reference to the fact that my country dropped the atomic bomb on two cities full of civilians, Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And I asked my father, why did we do that? And he said, bad intelligence. Which is a great answer that opens up in many dimensions. I'm sure he meant that, you know, the military intelligence was saying this had to be done to end the war. But, of course, there was bad intelligence all the way through the Manhattan Project, especially after the collapse of the German bomb effort. I remember seeing a documentary much later when one of the physicists, I think it might have been Robert Wilson, said, when we got the word that the German atomic bomb effort had collapsed, I don't know why I didn't get on a train and leave Los Alamos immediately. But we kept going, and as I learned when I was older, our military forces fighting Japan had by that time been bombing Japan, Tokyo for sure, and we had reserved three virgin targets, as they were called, Hiroshima, Nagasaki, and a third city. And they were never bombed because they were being saved. They were being saved so that the military could see in an experiment exactly what kind of damage this new weapon does to people and buildings, which really puts quite a different spin on it. And you may remember there was a big debate about the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki at the 60th anniversary in 2005, but it was framed entirely as, should we have dropped it or not? So all the men who were still alive who were soldiers who would have had to be in the invasion force, and a lot of them been killed, said, yes, it was a good thing we dropped it so I didn't have to be killed. But the debate was never framed as, should we have dropped it on an outer island to show Japan, we have this new weapon, see what it does to cows? We're going to do this on the mainland if you don't surrender immediately. That was completely missing out of the debate, that we had other options. So that's always been puzzling to me. And then a second incident was in 1971. My husband and I were living in Japan for a few months, and President Nixon made a surprise announcement that shocked the world, and that was that, with the advice of his Secretary of State, Henry Kissinger, he was going to visit China. He was going to make a visit opening diplomatic relations with mainland China. So you could hear all across the country, oh my gosh, the Chai Coms, he's going to visit the Chai Coms. Whoever thought a Republican would do this. So all that was interesting. But here's the way Japan received that. They were so insulted that they had not been told ahead of time through secret diplomatic, or let's just say confidential diplomatic channels, that this announcement was about to be made. I mean, they were profoundly insulted. And I remember the headline of the Mainichi Daily News said, U.S. declares war on Japan. They felt so threatened by this new connection, and they felt they were so strategically affected. And we were living in a beautiful little garden cottage owned by a Japanese family. And a couple of weeks after this happened, they told us we had to vacate. We had to leave. They couldn't have Americans on their property. So when we went back to the United States then, at the end of the summer, I was surprised that nobody knew about this. And I was reading a copy of the New Republic, and there was a column that used to be called the TRW column, and he wrote a story about Nixon's foreign policy blunders. And he listed about 12. And didn't seem to know about the fact that this had put Japan almost on the verge of, you know, as I say, declaring that we were in a hostile state with them. So I actually wrote him a letter, but that was the second time I thought, we seem so oblivious. Is it because we're geographically far away from Asia, far away from Europe? Or is there something else going on? And then the third incident, when I noticed this disparity between world opinion and our awareness of world opinion, of our foreign policy, was after the 9/11 attacks. And I wrote an op-ed piece then, and I want to read just a little bit to remind you of what it felt like in those first couple of weeks. So I said, The initial shock and grieving after the terrorist attacks instilled in the American psyche a gravitas, a deep sense of grounding that seemed to slow time in our mad dash world and to draw us into silent reflection rather than quick talk. Thinking felt as if it were weighted in our entire body. It refused to click into easy patterns as we sought to grasp the unimaginable new reality. In that palpable grounding the first week, we were all bonded with the dead and with each other. So people really were asking deep questions then and wanting to understand not only why this had happened, but why people had celebrated dancing in the streets in several countries around the world. And I remember Oprah on her program, she did two interesting things. One, she had all these State Department and government officials speaking who were all women. It was the last time you ever saw that on major media. But the second thing she does had features where she interviewed, you know, regular folks. I remember this man who owns some kind of small business, and he said, what? People hate us around the world? And I thought, well, they don't hate us, but didn't you ever know that they really suffer through several of our foreign policies over the past few decades? So all that was shut down, by the way, shut down by Cheney and Bush when, first of all, they tried to shift the debate of why did this happen to, we'll tell you why it happened. It's because these people are jealous of our hair dryers and our hamburgers and our freedom. Case closed. the second way they shut it down, of course, was on October 8th, where they made an announcement that we're now at war. We've sent military forces into Afghanistan. So that was the end of trying to figure out what was going on. It was really hijacked in two ways. So Finally, all this got me thinking about what the Jesuit priest John Sobrino said. He lived in El Salvador with six other Jesuit priests who were professors at the university there. And he was invited to go on a lecture tour in Thailand. And while he was away, his six colleagues, plus their cook and her daughter, were murdered in their quarters, you'll remember, at the university by government soldiers, as was proven later in court cases many years later. The only reason he survived, of course, you know, being away. So he went on a lecture trip of the United States trying to explain what the situation was down there, what they were trying to do. And he often felt that people didn't want to hear it. Oh, this is too political. He was going around to Catholic universities and different organizations. And in the light of that experience, he said, it's not a sin to not know about the suffering of other people, but it is a sin to not want to know. That was John Sobrino. Now, one thing before I introduce my guest today, in order to accommodate my guest's international travel schedule, we are pre-taping this interview 8 days before it will be aired. And some of the areas we're going to be discussing are in severe turmoil right now. Things seem to be changing every day. So if something has changed radically in the 8 days before you hear this, you'll wonder why we're not mentioning it. And it's because we are situated in the here and now. My guest today is Richard Falk. He's Albert G. Milbank Professor of International Law Emeritus at Princeton University, where he was a member of the faculty for 40 years. Since 2002, he's been associated with the Global and International Studies Program at the Santa Barbara campus of the University of California, where he is currently research professor and directs a research project on climate change, human security, and democracy. Professor Falk has been the special rapporteur in Occupied Palestine for the United Nations Human Rights Council since 2008. He served as chair of the board of the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation from 2004 to 2012. In 2008 to 2009, he was appointed expert advisor to the President of the United Nations General Assembly. He's a member of the editorial boards of The Nation, The Progressive, those both magazines, of course, and is an honorary editor of the American Journal of International Law and a member of the international advisory editorial boards of Third World Quarterly and Globalizations. Over the years, Richard Falk has published more than 50 books. That's 5-0, folks, 50 books, including Legal Order in a Violent World, This Endangered Planet, Prospects and Proposals for Human Survival, A Study of Future Worlds, Predatory Globalization, A Critique, Religion and Humane Global Governance. His most recent books are Achieving Human Rights, a co-edited volume entitled Legality and Legitimacy in Global Affairs, Global Parliament, co-authored, and Path to Zero, Dialogues on Nuclear Dangers. Richard Falk, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Charlene. It's very good to be with you, and it was very good to listen to your opening, which I found very fascinating in many ways.
Well, I wonder what your sense is of this general disparity I was addressing between what a lot of people in the world think about U.S. foreign policy and what most American citizens are aware of regarding the effects of our foreign policy.
Well, I was reflecting on that while you were giving these very illuminating kind of recollections that you had. And the sort of phrase that popped into my own mind was America's imperial mentality. Mm. And one of the characteristics, I think, of an imperial mentality is that you don't listen. You don't notice that you project your power. You have these illusions that is somehow benevolent and beneficial for others.
Mm-hmm.
Adlai Stevenson, the liberal democratic candidate for president in the 50s, I remember, said the item of technology that America most needs is a hearing aid. And I do think that is characteristic of the imperial relationship of dominant states to a subordinated world.
And wow, that's very interesting, especially when you say, and we don't know that we do that. We think, exactly. Our power is benevolent, and we don't know, as the phrase goes, you don't know what you don't know.
Exactly, and I think that accounts for this characteristic that is almost more bewildering to the rest of the world, and that is this, whatever we do, we retain this gloss of innocence. we bury even the history of our treatment of indigenous Native Americans and slavery, and all of that is somehow packaged in a way that we can keep saying, every president says it, including Barack Obama, we're the greatest country in the world, and projects this sense of America as a country blessed by God, as above sin, beyond sin, which of course is a contradiction of Christianity itself, but that doesn't matter politically.
Yeah, definitely. We have an entitlement complex.
Exactly.
I mean, with relation to the human family and the community of nations.
And the entitlement includes the mandate to kill whoever we think gets in the way.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's move into that speech President Obama made on May 23rd. And I noticed in a blog post you wrote that the fact that he chose to give this speech at the National Defense University should have given everyone a heads up that the ship of state was not going to take too much of a veering there. So what was your sense of that speech he gave?
Well, I think, as others have also said, that its rhetoric had encouraging flourishes,
right, especially
the idea that it was time to think about ending this war on terror, that the Pentagon would like to keep going as a sort of perpetual dimension of American security policy. I think if he acts upon that would be an important development. He was not very encouraging about the sort of specific expectations that had been mentioned prior to the speech, such as closing Guantanamo or ending what they call signature strikes with drones, that is, people that are identified as targets because they're young and male and gather in these tribal areas of Pakistan or Yemen or elsewhere. And there's no other evidence that they are engaged in combatant activity. Not that that itself is a sufficient ground to execute people throughout the world without any kind of pretense of due process.
Mm-hmm.
And also there was a supposed shift from uh, uh, with with respect to authority to use drones from the CIA to the Pentagon, which was supposedly more, somewhat more accountable, as though the Pentagon suddenly becomes a paragon of democratic virtue. I'm not sure that shift would have
Why was it put with the CIA in the first place?
Well, the CIA, I mean, the idea was to create this aura of legitimate secrecy, so to speak, and so that there would be no procedures of accountability. At least there's the potential for procedures of accountability when it comes to the Pentagon. Not that they would be implemented.
Uh-huh.
So I'm not sure it's a distinction, but I'm not sure it would be, turn out to be a difference. It's very hard to know how this would. I mean, when sometimes the CIA does better than the Pentagon. For instance, during the Vietnam War, the CIA was kept telling Washington they were losing the war, and the Pentagon kept suppressing the CIA pessimistic reports and having the guys that were writing those reports getting dismissed from their positions. So you can't.
Well, that was a situation, where we had one war zone. But just the Pentagon, I thought they felt overdrawn. Did they? If we kept up this global war on terrorism, which I was happy to hear the president say we'll move off of finally, and treat it as criminal acts by a private group who are not a state. But if you say the Pentagon would like it to go on, don't they feel overdrawn with like too many theaters at once if they're fighting global terrorism?
Well, that's a good. I think probably some do. I think there's probably a division in the Pentagon, but it's not a war in the conventional sense. It's and that's one of the appeals of the drone type war warfare is that you can do lots of things everywhere without straining too much. Because you don't have to have troops and ships everywhere.
Right.
You select targets, and they're trying to establish, as I understand it, as many as 6 drone bases in Africa alone. Mm-hmm. And so it is what I've called a global domination project, that it doesn't mean that it's replicating European colonialism and trying to have the American flag flying everywhere, but it does mean a kind of a discipline, a geopolitically imposed discipline on the non-Western world, except for China and India, I suppose.
Well, that brings me to a question I often wonder about. Why do we have more than 725 military bases around the world? I mean, time when we desperately need money to rebuild bridges, we're 25 years behind on infrastructure repair, why are we maintaining all those bases? Some people say with a secret bases it's closer to 1,000. But I saw a news item where one of the panels on the military in Congress said, we couldn't cut back the number of bases because that's our power projection. If we were to cut back the number, that would be a big hit to our power projection. So what's your sense of that?
Well, that's it. I mean, I think there are various rationalizations that we're providing stability for these other sectors of the world, that there needs to be, what international relations people call a hegemon, a dominant state that provides a kind of managerial oversight for the rest of the world, and we've appointed ourselves to that role and are paying for it. It's expensive.
No kidding.
And has very little.
Go ahead.
very little. I mean, the American people get almost no benefit and lots of detriment from this role, but they don't know it. You see, it's partly we're in denial and like the idea of being number one, you know.
But I think, again, they don't even realize we're paying for more than 725 bases around the world. There's just such a disconnect in the public.
Yeah, well, it's also most people, unfortunately, haven't learned the difference between being a citizen and being a subject.
And being
when
what?
It comes to Nash, a subject, you know, like a subject of a
Oh, a subject,
king.
yeah.
we're not citizens that act on the basis of what independent conscience, which is what I think a robust democracy depends upon. And people like Thomas Jefferson understood that very early in the history of the country. But we've lost that, particularly with national security. We've been perpetually at war since the late 1930s. I mean, first the Cold War. We had a little brief interregnum in the 1990s where economic globalization became the dominant motif of American foreign policy. And then since 2001, we've had the war on terror. So there's been a kind of perpetual idea that the country is at war and we have to rely upon those that are presiding over this policy. And all of our leaders, including the Democratic presidents, celebrate the glorify the role of the military. And so both
that was
feel
very clear. Go ahead.
It's almost subversive to criticize.
Oh, well, yes, it's certainly been called out in recent years, but that was a big difference between the first time President Obama was campaigning, and he said, Iraq, we invaded the wrong country. There are no Al-Qaeda terrorists in Iraq. And once he became president, he couldn't say that anymore because of all the people whose lives had been given to that effort. Anyway, we need to pause here for the break. This is Charlene Spretnak on All Together Now, speaking with my guest, Richard Falk.
Let's give them something to talk about, babe.
Welcome back to All Together Now. This is Charlene Spretnak on All Together Now, speaking with my guest, Richard Falk. He writes, by the way, a very substantive and interesting blog, and the address is Richard Falk, that's RICHARDFALK.wordpress, WORDPRESS.com. And when I first looked at that blog, I thought, well, for someone who's written 50 books and a gazillion articles, why would you take on the additional time-consuming job of writing these very well-crafted, substantive responses to current events? And then I saw a news item where one of your readers had taken issue with something you'd written, and she was the United States ambassador to the United Nations. So I see you have a very elevated readership in circles of international relations, which probably makes it more fun.
Overly attentive readership.
Overly attentive sometimes. Well, I want to ask a quick question before we move into Syria and Palestine. And that's something I remember you were saying several years ago. We were both at a conference, and we were talking about your work as a member of the Independent International Commission on Kosovo, which was loosely affiliated with the United Nations, and it was funded mainly by Sweden. And I remember you saying then that you'd observed that people in post-war areas often do not welcome UN or other peacekeeping forces so much as resent their being there because they're foreign soldiers on their land. So I thought that was very interesting. That was something I was ignorant of. Could you tell us what you've observed about that in such situations?
Well, I think that each situation is rather unique, and so it's difficult to generalize. But
mm-hmm.
What I have observed is that very often these UN peacekeepers are young and not properly prepared to be deployed in these countries which are different cultures and they're very isolated from what's familiar to them, and they often don't behave very well, and there've been and abuses of women and a lot of, and because the UN hasn't wanted to be discredited, these are often covered up, and there's a sense for the two different reasons for questioning these UN presences. One is this kind of abuse on the ground, and the other is that they're seen as instruments of the West and a kind
right.
of new form of colonial occupation
right.
in a sense, and usually they are paid for by mainly by the West, which exercises principal influence over the way in which UN peacekeepers are deployed and used, and the choices made of which where they will be used and where they won't be used is very much a decision made by the Western superpower members of the
right.
UN
well,
Security Council.
Yeah. Yeah, I learned from you, and then I started paying attention to it, and I saw that in several cases. That is the perception. But
and it
this also makes, oh,
maybe the most fundamental reason, and I think that was partly true in Kosovo, is that there is a perception by people on the ground in these countries that this is encroaching upon their right of self-determination.
Right, right.
And the right of self-determination is really the basis of political legitimacy in almost every society in the world.
Well, yes, but as we've discussed, the ancient nations are still struggling. I noticed in the war crimes trial in The Hague the other day, there was an article saying someone had been let off in the Serbian official just under Milosevic, who you know had signed a requisition for arms to go to these thugs, these paramilitaries who were killing all these civilians in Bosnia, this is a previous trial where they said, well, there isn't any evidence that the people they were giving the arms to were going to do illegitimate things with them. It would be okay for them to just shoot down citizens who had taken an independence vote. But if they were going to do nasty things like line up people and execute them, that would be a bad thing. But it would be totally legitimate. Anyway, this is a bigger subject about the ancient nations who've been surrounded by the modern states and how they're still struggling to get recognition. But I just want to say, you're talking about lands. That's such an important position, and in that horrific murder on the streets in London last week, where the two men from Africa Islamic hit this soldier, British soldier, with a car, and then got up and murdered and carved him up with a machete and a meat cleaver, and the one was yelling, "Get out of our lands! Get out of our lands and leave us alone!" So the fact that, you know, Western forces are occupying their homes is just like issue number one, I think, even if they're peacekeepers who've stopped hostilities. But we have a limited amount of time, and I want to hear your take on what's going on with Syria now, which is so charged. It seems to be one of those periods now where a lot is suddenly happening. And I just want to explain, give a little context here to the readers. There are a lot of parties involved who seem to want different things from the United States. Israel primarily wants us to help get control of that dangerous stockpile of chemical weapons that Assad has built up. And Lebanon and Jordan want us to help them with this huge flow of refugees coming out of war-torn Syria. And then, of course, the opposition forces want us to supply them with serious military support. And I read that the European Union just changed their policy a couple of days ago, and they'll begin shipping arms to them. So what are your observations on that situation?
Well, I feel it's a very tragic. I mean, the tragedy for the Syrian people is that they're caught in this crossfire between various domestic tendencies and a regime that is very bloody-minded in dealing with opposition.
Yeah.
That is magnified by what people call the proxy war dimension, which is Russia and Iran on the side of the Assad government, and the West, Western Europe and U.S., Qatar and Turkey and Saudi Arabia on the side of the opposition forces. And the opposition is not able to project any kind of political unity or to give any credibility to the fact that they would provide Syria with a more humane form of governance than is has been provided by the dictatorial regime of Assad. So it is a genuine tragic predicament with the people caught in between these various forms of extremist violence that are destroying the country and destroying the ancient cities of Syria, which was one of the centers of world civilization at one time. And I think nobody that is trying to be objective and figure out what would be the best thing to do knows exactly what to do. There's a situation of radical uncertainty as to what would bring this violence to an end and try to find some kind of transition. And I've been sort of in a hesitant way proposing a diplomacy of compromise, which the United States hasn't been advocating. And diplomacy of compromise, I think, has to be premised upon both sides in the internal conflict coming to an awareness that they cannot gain their objectives on the battlefield. Until they come to that awareness, these outside forces giving more arms will probably lead to more arms being provided to the Assad government by its allies and just magnifying and prolonging the violence. So it's a desperate situation that illustrates the extreme vulnerability of this world order's structure that we have, that on the one hand gives sovereign states this unlimited authority to deal with their own population as they see fit.
Right.
And on the other side has no way of protecting what might be called the human interest.
Right.
So you're caught between geopolitical tensions that are very strategic, connected with oil, connected with security of Israel, a lot of those goals that you described the neighboring countries having, and deferring to this inferno that is internal to Syria at this point.
Right. It seems
so
surprising to me that it keeps going on for so long.
Yes, and nobody knows. As I say, it's unlike Libya and other places where there was a clear imbalance between the government and the society. In Syria, as far as one can tell, the opposition and the societal forces that continue to support the regime are sufficiently balanced that it is not likely that the conflict can be resolved by this violent encounter.
I see. Well, let's hope things settle down and that there could be a diplomatic solution.
But there has to be the political will to. Everybody says, of course, they seek a diplomatic solution, but what they don't say is their version of a diplomatic solution is tantamount to achieving a political victory.
And right. I saw an article the other day that there's supposed to be some negotiations, and the plan of the West is that the idea of the negotiations is Assad will agree to resign and go away. He seems to be not in that mindset whatsoever, although many a dictator has insisted right up to the last moment that he's not giving up his position. But is that the case? Are there negotiations planned?
Yes, there's to be some kind of meeting in Geneva that Syria has agreed to participate in.
Oh, right, in Geneva, okay.
And that's supposed to take place in June. But as I say, if Assad were to be forced to leave or agree to leave, that would be tantamount to a victory by the opposition.
Sure.
And on the other hand, if the opposition is forced to give up their weapons and trust the Assad regime to administer free elections, that would be tantamount to a victory by the regime.
Right.
So that what I favor is a diplomacy of compromise that somehow recognizes the minimal needs of these two antagonistic forces.
Uh-huh. Hard to imagine, but fingers crossed. Let's hope for the best.
Yeah. It is hard to imagine, but so are the alternatives.
Yeah, definitely, I agree. Well, I'd like to hear about your work as the United Nations Special Rapporteur for Occupied Palestine under the auspices of the Human Rights Council in Geneva. So what have you learned about the situation there since you began that position in 2008?
Well, of course, this position is very contested, and part of my own experience is to sort of fight off ultra-Zionist criticism that tries to paint me as an anti-Semite because I submit what I believe to be honest reports of the violations of Palestinian rights. Mm. So there is that confusion in the that is created, particularly in this country, between criticism of Israel and anti-Semitism as a form of unacceptable racism, which I detest as much as the Zionists claim to. But what one sees is in the essential reality of the Palestinians is to experience a constant diminishing of their prospects for a history of their own, the expansion of Israeli settlements, the gradual demographic transformation of East Jerusalem into a Jewish part of the city, and the blockade and isolation of Gaza for more than 6 years, all of these developments create a situation which leaves very little prospect that the traditional conception of a solution, which is a second state in historic Palestine that would serve the interests of the Palestinian people in the way that Israel has served the interests of the Jewish people, that becomes hard to visualize how that might happen.
And of course, Israel says we, at least a lot of Israelis, oppose a two-state solution, not all, but because we're surrounded by all these Islamic nations who have publicly said they want to push us into the sea. They'll never rest until Israel doesn't exist. Not only states have said that, like the president of Iran, but private organizations, they're dedicated to eradicating Israel. So they feel if they were an independent Palestinian state, it would have that complete sovereignty, and they could import all kinds of weapons there right on Israel's doorstep. Isn't that their fear?
Well, that's their propaganda.
Ah.
I would distinguish it from their fear.
Okay.
Actually, the all the Arab governments have proposed normalization with Israel if it withdraws to the 67 boundaries and allows East Jerusalem to be the capital of a independent Palestine.
That, which countries have said that?
Or there's in 2002, and they just recently reaffirmed it in relation to our Secretary of State John Kerry.
Right, but does it include Iran?
The so-called Arab Initiative. Well, Iran, as you know, is not an Arab country.
Right. But they're the ones that are really funding a lot of...
They've always been Ahmadinejad, who's no angel, has been misquoted, and his comments have been translated in the most inflammatory possible way.
I see.
He's never said, never used these metaphors of pushed into the sea. He has argued, as some others have argued, that the only just solution is to end the idea of a Jewish Zionist state and to create a, in effect, a secular Palestine that has boundaries corresponding to the boundaries of the of historic Palestine, and it's a solution that many Palestinian intellectuals have also endorsed, including Edward Said and Sari Makdisi and Ali Abi Nima. So it's something, in many ways, the idea of an ethnic religious state, which it seems inconsistent with human rights. For instance, in pre-67 Israel, there are over 1.5 million Palestinians. Are they supposed to be content to be in as second-class citizens in a Jewish state?
No. The case is very strong there that something has to change for them. Definitely complete
but
independent statehood.
How can you reconcile Zionism in that sense with human
rights? We've run out of time here, I'm sorry to say. There's so many things I'd love to ask you about. But Richard Falk,
quite a bit of ground.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the program.
No, I've enjoyed it, and it's you do a very good program.
Thank you. Well, let's move over to the Arts Corner and see what we have there. For our poem this week, we have one by Hafiz. Hafiz, the 14th century Persian poet and Sufi master from Shiraz. In this poem, by the way, the words friend and the beloved are capitalized to refer to divine presence. This poem is Burglars Hear Watchdogs. If one is afraid of losing anything, they have not looked into the friend's eyes. They have forgotten God's promise. The jewels you get when you meet the beloved go on multiplying themselves. They take root everywhere. They keep mating all the time like spring-warmed creatures. Burglars hear watchdogs inside of his gifts and run. For our song, in keeping with some of the topics we've heard today, we'll hear a song sung by a Tunisian singer that became known as the anthem of the Arab Spring. The song is entitled Kelmti Hura, or My Word is Free, and it's sung by Emil Maluti. Anthem of the Arab Spring, My Word is Free, sung by Emil Maluti. In case you've missed any of these programs, they're available in the archives. If you like this program, please go to iTunes and like it there. Our theme song is Let's Give Them Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. If you'd like to see who my guests will be for the next few weeks, go to my website, CharleneSpretnak.com, and click on the tab that says Radio. Next week, my co-host, Eleanor LeCain, will be here. I'll be back 2 weeks from today. Thanks for joining us. This is Charlene Spretnak with All Together Now.
Now that we know it, let's really show.